Jason Turner joins us again, Chief Investment Strategist, Wintrust Wealth Management. Welcome back. How are you today?
Doing well. Good to be with you, John.
Jason, are you in a good mood about the Dow today? It's up a couple hundred.
Hey, anything in green looks like a good mood to me.
It's funny, though, because the news about Medicare and Social Security running out has, I think, dampened a lot of people's spirits this week. I know we're not talking about that per se, but boy, that does seem to be sort of a black cloud out there, doesn't it?
It does, and it seems to be a recurring black cloud that keeps creeping up on us from a news cycle perspective every now and then, and it does tend to weigh on the consciousness of the nation, so to speak.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, it is what it is, so let's do something about it. And I only maybe reference that here because as happy as I am about any day the market's up, I'm like you, green is good, but black is bad. And it's so I'll do everything I can to personally make myself able to retire someday. But if Social Security doesn't have the money in 10 years when I'm ready to retire or somebody else is into retirement, well then... shoot, now I have to reimagine how much money I'm going to save or invest because maybe I can't rely on Social Security. So I'm happy that the market's better and I'm anxious for this recession to resolve itself. But maybe even more importantly is that bigger picture. You see where I'm coming from?
That's exactly where you're coming from, John. And then the long-term picture is something that we're acutely focused on. And what we do day-to-day for clients and that inclusion or exclusion of Social Security and that planning decision is one we tend to skew towards plan without it, and if it's there, it's there.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, if I plan without it, maybe I'll plan with 75% of it. I mean, you're not suggesting that down the road people should imagine a world without any Social Security income, are you?
No. Advocating for the point of, and let's make sure that you've taken care of yourself to the extent you can take care of yourself instead of crossing your fingers and relying on something being 100% there in the future.
The March Producer Price Index, what happened there and what does that mean for the near term?
So March Producer Price Index, something encouraging with wholesale prices actually coming back. It's the first time it's actually receded. It's slowed down pretty consistently over the course of the last year, but this is the first month we've actually seen it back up. And that's big because producers actually saw their wholesale prices go up more than consumers. This peaked at almost 12%, where we peaked on the consumer price inflation side at 9%. Business owners saw their input prices peak at nearly 12% inflation on a year-over-year basis early last year. So this is a good news item that inflation on the producer side, that typically, although not always, leads consumer price inflation, is easing, and those pressures on businesses are easing.
It's funny because I think about that in terms of interest rates when the Fed, where 25 basis points was seen as a hooray, it's going in the other direction. But no, it's still going up. It's not going down. It's just not going up as much. It has to slow down before it goes down. So I guess that's where we are.
And that's exactly where we are. We've passed that point with producer prices where they've slowed down and now they've gone down. We're seeing the consumer prices slow down, although in some areas not as fast as we'd like. And that those two eventually, hopefully, lead to the Fed going from slowing down to stopping their rate hikes.
Well, in this, the good news is bad news and vice versa. Is this good news somehow bad news, or is this good news good news?
I think on the producer price side, this is good news is good news. The impact of producer prices being higher and being higher and running faster than consumers was impactful to businesses, was something that businesses took their time in passing all those price increases on to consumers. This is hopefully that light at the end of the tunnel that says businesses won't need to keep passing on price increases to consumers, and maybe some of that persistent inflation in core goods and core services starts to erode as we move forward throughout the year.
Well, I'm going to call you more often.
It's a little rosy picture there for you, John.
Imagine that on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Jason Turner is the Chief Investment Strategist at Wintrust Wealth Management. Wintrustwealth.com to find out more. Hey, Jason, thanks for your thoughts today.
Good to talk to you, John.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with your devices. CNET senior reporter Bree Fowler joins us. Bree, how are you today?
Great. How's it going?
Good. I love this sort of sub-headline on your site. The Twitter soap opera continues.
It just never seems to stop.
Well, this isn't important in the world, but for instance, National Public Radio, NPR, said we're not going to use Twitter anymore because that our blue check mark will go with the designation that we're a state-owned media or something like that, right?
Right. I mean, and this is actually, I think, really important because a lot of people do use Twitter as a way to get kind of an aggregated news feed. And, you know, they look to that for legitimate news sources. And when legitimate news sources pull out because they're being lumped in with the likes of propaganda wagons from Russia and China, you know, then Twitter just isn't a really good news source for people anymore.
Well, a partisan view of NPR is that they are just that. They argue back that less than 1% of their financing comes from the government. If you hear in NPR a left lean, maybe you do. It seems like Twitter is just punching back a little bit. They're needling them with the designation on their check mark.
Well, I mean, Twitter has always had kind of an adversarial relationship with the media in general. I mean, they basically got rid of a lot of their PR staff. So as a reporter, you know, when I try to contact them for comment, I just can't get anyone anymore. I mean, they purposefully make things difficult for the legitimate media overall. They also tried to do this to the BBC, which doesn't receive any funding from the government.
Well, maybe you should find Elon Musk's dog and ask him what's going on over there. They laid off 80% of their staff. At least that's what he said he has done. Is that verifiably true?
Well, there's no really any way to verify that or his claims that the company is about breaking even right now because they're a private company. There's no SEC filings. There's no disclosures to shareholders because they just don't have to do that. We're taking this at its word. I mean, that said, though, if you get rid of 80% of the company, it's a lot easier to balance your budget.
Well, and I'm sorry for those people, but it does sound like they were a little bloated.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you look at it. And the problem is you have to look at what jobs are being cut. Twitter, even if it's trying its best, has an uphill battle when it comes to dealing with disinformation and bots and hate speech. And the fact is, you can automate a lot of the response to that, but you still need people going through and dealing with reported posts and keeping all of that mess out. And when you get rid of that kind of staff, you just don't have a quality product or service or even something that's safe to use anymore.
Yeah, safe to use is kind of the buzzword or words around TikTok these days. What's the news on TikTok?
Well, TikTok is another soap opera that doesn't seem to end. Politicians at the federal level have been talking about banning TikTok for quite some time now. I mean, going back to the Trump administration, he tried to do this. But the question is, you know, is there a legal authority to do something like this in a country like America? And then also from a technical standpoint, if you could actually pull it off. Mm-hmm. Security experts will say that, you know, there is a risk to national security from TikTok just because of, even if they aren't tied to the Chinese government, the Chinese government might be able to get that information even if TikTok doesn't want them to. And getting a vast data set of the information of Americans from an app like this is way more efficient for the Chinese government than any kind of spy balloon.
And that point you just made resonates with me. I'm not a conspiracy person. I think we tend to worry about things we don't need to worry about, but I so distrust the Chinese, I could see them using, even if it was against TikTok's will. I mean, I thought that the CEO of TikTok that testified before Congress last month sure seems sincere, but I almost felt like that's beside the point. What do you say to all of that?
You know, the fact is we just don't know how much access the Chinese government has to ByteDance, the parent company, which is based in China, and TikTok, which is actually based in LA and Singapore. There's just really no way to know. But at the same time, when you talk to security experts, their attitude is, you know, the problem isn't necessarily with TikTok. A lot of the concerns and accusations that were made during that congressional hearing recently really apply to all of social media. I mean, you have to look at things like Facebook and Instagram. They're hoovering up your data, too, and selling it and sharing it. And there's really no regulation when it comes to data privacy in the United States. Other countries, the EU, for example, have stepped up and put rules into effect to govern this kind of stuff. We haven't done that here, and that's really what politicians should be focusing on.
TikTok's been banned in India and other countries. I mean, India's 600 million potential users. They don't have access to it. And states across the country, Utah has limited TikTok's accessibility for people. I think Montana's thinking about doing that. Almost half of our states have some restrictions, don't they?
Well, the state restrictions generally right now deal with what you can do with a government phone. And that's a lot easier to police because the government is an employer. If you have a work phone, your employer has the right to say, be using TikTok with this work phone. You shouldn't be playing Candy Crush for 3 hours with your work phone. That's nothing new. And the employers and state governments, city governments, they can put software on that phone to monitor what you're doing. That's really nothing new. To take it to a level where you would ban it for all Americans would be extremely tough at a state level because cell towers go back and forth between different states. And also, you know, there are civil liberties issues there, freedom of speech, but then also we don't have the controls over devices and telecom providers that, like China, for example, does. I mean, they have their great firewall where they can censor news sites. They can do things like that. We don't actually have that capability right now, and I don't know if people actually want to see that happen in this country.
Give me 30 seconds on HBO Max without HBO. It's going to be called Max, and there's going to be tiered pricing, right?
Right. It currently has tiered pricing now. What they're doing is they're changing the name. This kind of goes back to the Warner Media merger with Discovery because they're incorporating Discovery now. HBO Max is now going to be called Max. You still have to pay extra for Discovery, which includes things like HGTV and the Food Network. Ad-free pricing for HBO, you're looking at $10 a month, $16 for ad-free, and then they have a kind of ultimate option right now for $20 a month for those people that are really, really into their HBO.
When does this all roll out?
End of May in the U.S., May 23rd to be exact.
So if I'm an HBO Max user now, will I have to select one and then start to pay accordingly?
Now, you should just kind of roll into the current tier that you have now, the comparable service. Maybe they'll try to upsell you to that ultimate plan. Uh-huh. But, you know, if you use it through an app or your cable provider, you'll probably notice the logo changing on that app or that channel. But that's about it.
Got it. Hey, Bree, this has been very helpful. Bree Fowler is a senior reporter at CNET. Thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Juliana Kaplan joins us now from Business Insider. Let's talk a little bit about this with them. You're actually a senior labor and inequality reporter at Business Insider. Juliana, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Welcome back. So the boom bust generation is the headline of an article that was recently pushed out by you guys. What's this story about?
Yeah, well, so this story is basically about what the sort of wild swings of the pandemic economy meant for Americans' financial habits or economic habits, especially younger workers, and sort of the scars that's going to leave behind just that weird pandemic economy.
Yeah, you're talking about the money that suddenly fell into everybody's lap and the creative ways they found to spend it, and now the old world, which has come back, correct?
Yeah, you know, obviously, like things like stimulus checks talk about the impact that unemployment, enhanced unemployment benefits had, and then also some of the weird byproducts as well. You know, one source in this, and this was definitely resonant with my experience, as I am a 26-year-old myself, you know, he spent a lot of his money on going out and going to restaurants and being out with friends, right? All of those were things you couldn't do. So all of a sudden, he was saving a lot of money sort of accidentally as well.
That was the boom. What's the bust then? What's the second part of that?
Well, have you tried to buy eggs? No. Yeah, the bust is obviously when we started emerging on the other side in sort of this post-vaccine era. People could go out and do things. You know, at first, a lot of people, this source actually called it his feral era, which I thought was funny. A lot of people were going out, spending a lot. They wanted a lot of stuff. And then here comes inflation, and now we have our current economy, and it's a very different situation.
You wrote, feeling powerless and adrift in your circumstances weighs on mental health and makes you feel more distressed. To counteract that, many people try to find activities that give them a sense of control back. I mean, this is not just an inconvenience, or it's not just a boom or a bust. You're talking about life-altering feelings here, aren't you?
Yeah. You know, some of it is definitely like a boomer bust and some funny anecdotes, but the real thrust of the piece, and I think the big takeaway here, is that these had very real impacts on people. You know, your reaction to something that is pretty wildly traumatic and dramatic, and for many people drastically changed their financial circumstances, is going to leave a scar. And something else that might happen from there, you know, we have all these so-called overlapping crises that are going to keep happening. We're potentially headed into another recession. Like, you know, these are wounds that might never close for a lot of younger people.
In the part of the piece, spending for control, what were you talking about there?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, for those people who accidentally saved, that was one course. But I talked to one person who racked up thousands of dollars in credit card debt just because, you know, when you're somewhere like locked in your apartment with nowhere to go and no one to see and things are just not happening as they should be, like, you buy to have a sense of control. She was saying the mechanism of knowing that she could click order and have something come to her door was really comforting, and it's really soothing, right? And, you know, I talked to a financial expert as well, who said that something she saw with a lot of her clients is that maybe they were like intermittent online spenders, and, you know, obviously online shopping like massively ballooned during the pandemic for obvious reasons. And sort of that ease of access and feeling like they were spiraling out of control pushed a lot of people into legitimate shopping addiction. And that's something that, you know, an addiction is an addiction, and that's something that you're going to have to figure out how to treat for the rest of your life.
I'm not a psychologist, but it would seem to me like that sort of click and spend was a connection to the world. I mean, you know, you weren't going to stores, you weren't interacting with people, but this was a way to reach out to the world, gather goods, bring them back in. Somebody made them, somehow they got to you. So it was tangible in that way. And I don't mean to make too much out of that, but I think there's something to what I just said, isn't there?
No, absolutely. And I think something too, and I don't touch on this in the article, but if you think about it, like, it was a really moral thing as well, right? In 2020, like, you were doing a very good and moral thing by ordering from a small business or like a woman-owned business, for instance. And, you know, those are obviously good, important things to do because you are helping support somebody and like support that product as well. But I mean, we live in a very capitalist society, and if the only way that you can really show support is through spending your money, that makes sense. But I think also the idea of spending became somewhat imbued with a whole lot of like baggage as well, you know?
Well, it's funny because I thought a lot of people were saving money, that credit card debt went down during the pandemic, and maybe for certain demographics it did, but I'm going to quote from your piece here. Other young people were also racking up debt. Millennials' debt shot up by 27% to $3.8 trillion from 2019 to the end of 2022, according to the New York Fed, and delinquencies on that debt are growing. Is this a generational thing? Older people saved and younger people spent?
I mean, I think it's more of like where you are in terms of your financial life, right? Like, I think that is one trend. But if you think sort of demographically, like, there's a Gen Xer in the piece who, you know, is partnered, has a spouse, is like pretty well settled into a career. And for her, her reaction was really thinking about the things that brought meaning, pretty much ended up stop like all extraneous spending and bought a farm. And if you think about, you know, millennials and Gen Zers, of which I am one, like, you know, people are increasingly single later in life, you know, they're renters. You know, the most you can do is maybe like buy a new couch for your rental apartment due to, you know, the sort of a generation that you were born into. Obviously, there's student loan debt as well. And also, we know that early career and younger workers were disproportionately impacted by layoffs at the start of the pandemic. You know, workers who were a little more settled were cushioned in a little bit more as well.
Juliana Kaplan is a senior labor and inequality reporter at BusinessInsider.com. Hey, Juliana, nice reporting. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news. This is Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A University of Chicago economics professor says Chicago will be lucky not to lose money on the 2024 Democratic National Convention. Alan Sanderson is throwing cold water on the city's projection of between $150 and $200 million in economic impact. He tells Cranes the impact will be based on several issues, including social unrest and how people feel about Mayor-elect Brandon Johnson. Sanderson says it's possible tourists will avoid the city because of the convention, and people who live here might skip town to avoid potential hassles tied to the event. If there is a boost, he says it'll be limited to hotels and restaurants. The cost of the convention could be $90 million or more, but most of that's expected to be funded by private donors. Lyle-based Navistar expects a big increase in the sales of electric trucks and buses this year. The company's CEO tells Cranes Navistar expects a tenfold increase in sales with delivery of 2,000 EVs in 2023. It previously announced plans for half of its sales to be zero emission by 2030 and a complete EV conversion by 2040. Navistar currently has 200 electric trucks and buses on the road. The company says it's also looking for a new partner for its driverless technology. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, here we go. Business of Food Time and Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and oh my, it's a beautiful time in our town, and we'll talk tulips after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. And as the tulips are beginning to pop along Michigan Avenue, there is an explosion of color about 10 days away at Richardson's Adventure Farm.
Yes, this will be our third season of tulips.
That is George Richardson. He's one of the owners of a Northern Illinois farm that goes way back.
Yes, 1836.
Yeah, that's when George's great-great-grandfather started tilling the soil.
So now it's my wife and I and my brother and his wife and my son.
But the corn, soybeans, and pigs model that their forefathers and mothers started ended when George and his brother Robert experimented with growing Christmas trees.
We started selling those, and then we realized that we like talking with people a lot more than we like talking with pigs. And people smell better. Got rid of the pigs. Started the corn maze, the world's largest corn maze and adventure farm.
And 3 years ago, the Richardsons added tulips to their agritourism operation, and George says from the first bloom, it was a hit.
It was just phenomenal. People walking around with the biggest smiles on their faces.
And this year, rows and rows of over a million tulips are about to bloom.
I think we're a week or two away from bloom. I'm looking at about April 21 right now. That's just based on the forecasted weather.
Tulips of all colors, over 12 acres.
Like 12 football fields all put together.
Man, there's more to do than just ooh and ah at the tulips.
We've got food trucks down there and beer and wine garden and yard games for the kids, some live music on weekends.
The Richardson Farm is north of Chicago, about an hour and 20 minutes.
Up I-94, and we're just 14 miles west on 173.
And you can go to richardsonfarm.com to find out more about the best time for you to a cameo by Tiny Tim. From the farm to your belly, today's National Peach Cobbler Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
I'm looking now at some of the numbers from the Chicago Loop Alliance about how more and more people are, in fact, coming downtown. Kiana DeStazzi is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for the Loop Alliance. Kiana, it's John Williams. Welcome back.
Good to talk to you again, John. Thanks for having me.
So what are the latest numbers?
Oh, well, quarter one is looking good for the Loop in downtown Chicago. Pedestrian rates are 120% higher than the same period in 2021 and a considerable amount higher than this period in 2022. Arts and culture, likewise, is booming. This past quarter, over 800,000 people enjoyed theater, music, art, the Art Institute, cultural attractions, and special events in the Loop. That had an economic impact of over $200 million, probably more than that if you take inflation into account, because that data is kind of pulled from how we used to judge arts and culture before the pandemic. Hotels, the average occupancy rate has doubled from 2022 and nearly tripled from 2021. And the final week in March, which is the latest week that we have data on, showed an increase actually from 2019, which is the last year pre-pandemic levels. We exceeded 2019 occupancy in hotels by 7% of 2019. And also, John, I have so much for you. Yes, sir.
No, no. Finish that thought. Keep going.
Yeah. Also, there's a lot of information in here that Chicago Loop Lions puts out in these reports. But another exciting thing is that Chicago office occupancy is leading the way for major U.S. cities outside of Texas. So the Texas cities are a little bit of an anomaly based on the other major cities reporting. But outside of the major cities in Texas, we are leading U.S. cities in terms of office occupancy. And we are less than one percentage point behind Dallas on our most occupied days of the week.
That was the category I was going to ask about, because that's the one that has such a ripple effect. But it's still around, what did I see? I didn't see that in your report. Is it around 50%?
Right. Well, you know, we're actually looking into how that number is pooled. So we actually are pulling back from using that number because we want to get a little bit more articulated about what that data is, because I think it's a little bit misleading to people. So we've been talking with Castle Systems, who are the people who actually pool that information and data. And the 50% number is a little bit misleading. They, in terms of the folks who are coming into the office in Chicago, on the most occupied days of the week, there are closer to maybe 73% of the office force in the office. However, when you're saying how many people are actually back in the office, like at least in a hybrid way, whether that's 1 to 4 times a week, we're seeing that it's closer to 75 to 90% of people are actually coming back to their office at some point during the week. It's just not in a 5 days a week capacity like it used to be. And we're talking to Castle Systems about how they might be able to report that data a little bit in a little bit more detail, because we think it's really important to the people who are making large real estate and leasing decisions in the city of Chicago and around the country. So Castle Systems is currently looking into that for us to kind of provide you with more details in terms of how people are experiencing the office. Because if you're down here, you're seeing that it's definitely more than 50% of people that are coming back to the office every day, and probably even more than the 63%. So we'll see. And not every day, but I mean, at some point during the week.
And we're just now on the cusp of tourist season in the city. Not that it's not always that, but a lot of folks come to Chicago when the weather gets warmer. You sure do see a lot of bodies popping. You do count pedestrians, right?
Yeah, so pedestrian counting is something that we actually specialize here in at Chicago Loop Alliance. We have pedestrian counters on State Street and at other places throughout the Loop. And that's another thing that kind of reassures us that the numbers that are coming downtown are more than what is being reported by Castle Systems. So our pedestrian counts, there were weeks in this past quarter where we were more around 83% of 2019 levels, which is about, you know, 17% down from 2019. That gives you a much more hopeful number than when people are thinking that things are half full, because that's really not what we're seeing here on the ground. Part of that is that people's use has changed. So although there might be less people coming to the office, we are definitely rebounding in terms of arts and culture, education, and residential sectors, along with tourism, as you can see from the hotel numbers sort of starting to spike as we get nicer weather.
One last thing. Do you have anything to say about the restaurant business in the city?
You know, the restaurant business is really ties along with all of these different sectors. So as you see increases in arts and culture, in hotels, in pedestrian, in office, the restaurant sector spikes as well. So they're sort of going along for the ride. I will say that if you want to try to get a reservation around the time of the major theaters having all their productions downtown here, when there's over 30,000 people, you know, downtown at one time, perhaps seeing different arts and culture experiences, you will have a hard time getting in at any nice restaurant down in the Loop if you don't have a reservation. So there's certain peak times where they're definitely excelling, and then other times where there's still challenges.
Kiana, with things like Lollapalooza and the National NASCAR event, exclude the DNC from this maybe, but I think people on the one hand say that's great, but on the other hand, that's going to crowd other people out. Do you see, say, NASCAR coming to Chicago as a net positive for the Loop? Is that going to be better than if we had cleared that space out and let everybody else come in?
That's a great question. I know there's been a lot of concern and praise for that event on both sides in terms of it coming to Chicago. I would say what's really encouraging, well, first of all, whenever we have a major event like Lollapalooza or like NASCAR, the Loop economy and the Chicago economy as a whole definitely does see a positive impact from that. We have the data on that from our businesses, from our pedestrian counts, from all of those reports that we do in the Loop. I would say what's really even more heartening about the NASCAR situation is that they have a team here on the ground in Chicago that is getting invested in the community and listening to all the concerns. We were just in a meeting with them earlier this week where they were talking about what they were going to do to ease the sound and put mufflers on their cars in a way they haven't done except for one other event ever in the history of NASCAR. So they're down and getting involved in the community level, and I think finding ways to ease people's concerns. I would say if you were to ask me yes or no, is it a net positive? I would say absolutely NASCAR is a net positive for the Loop and for the city of Chicago. Beyond just the economic impact when they're here in the city, they are going to be showcasing days and hours worth of beautiful, positive perception of the city of Chicago, our beautiful skyline on national and international. I mean, people just don't get to see that. And folks who may not necessarily have the brightest, the greatest examples of what's happening in downtown Chicago. So I think that the simple answer to that question is yes, it's a positive. The more complicated answer is that I'm glad to see that NASCAR is taking community concerns seriously and addressing every single issue. They've said they're invested in the Loop and the city of Chicago as a whole for the next 3 years at least. So they want to be on the ground year-round, just not one weekend in July.
Kiana DeStazzi is the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer at the Chicago Loop Alliance. The report at loopchicago.com. Kiana, thank you for your thoughts today.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.